Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, award-winning investigative journalist Andrea Bernstein, has been writing about politics and political corruption for 25 years. Since November of 2016, writing and reporting about the Trump and Kushner families and their family businesses has presented a unique set of challenges for Andrea. Their companies are privately and closely held, with financial deals that stretch back decades and around the globe. For her new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power, Andrea Bernstein spent 3 years reading over 100,000 pages of documents. She looked at more than 100 books and thousands of news articles. She's listened to weeks of hearings and testimony, mined audio archives, reviewed years worth of social media accounts, and watched scores of hours of videotapes, movies, and documentaries. She writes, quote, 20 years into the 21st century, we live in an age of oligarchs where the very richest Americans hold vast sway, not only over their elected officials and by extension the courts, but also the election process itself. Andrea Bernstein is an award-winning journalist and co-host of Trump Inc. It's a podcast from WNYC and ProPublica. She covers the business of the Trump administration and has broken key stories, including how Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump avoided criminal indictment, Paul Manafort's money laundering, and Rudy Giuliani's ties with Ukraine. And Andrea is out with a new book called American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Andrea Bernstein joins us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Hi, Andrea. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's really great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for writing this book and just doing so much research. When I read your notes on sources, I thought, wow, she really spent time reading. And let's just start there, Andrea. I mean, you have written about political corruption for 25 years, but you make a point to really emphasize that it's difficult reporting on the Kushners and Trumps because they are so secretive.
Right. I mean, it is a whole new world. And it's a whole new world for a variety of reasons. One is because we have this unprecedented in modern history situation where we have a president profiting from his business and maintaining ties to his business while he's president. So we haven't seen anything like that. So just every day with Trump, people pay him. They pay him at his hotels. They book not only rooms for to stay in, but also for events. They are members of his golf club. They buy condos from him. So we see this situation of direct payments to the president that we've never seen before. And of course, there's no system of disclosure for that other than obviously social media, but nothing like the campaign finance system. Then the disclosure system at the White House is not designed for the president to have to disclose who his investors are, to whom he owes money, who his business partners are. All of that we don't know. And then you layer on top of that that this is an especially secretive administration. They don't hand out White House visitor logs. Trump has insisted that most White House officials sign non-disclosure agreements whose legality has been questioned, but people are afraid to violate them because they see what Trump does to people who cross him on Twitter, the bullying at the campaign rallies, the things he says at the right from the East Room of the White House. All of that has made it very, very hard to cover this administration and its financial dealings thoroughly, as we have covered other presidents in the past who have not been playing by this set of rules at all.
It's also amazing, and this doesn't really get talked about. In fact, I almost forgot about it, but the White House has stopped doing press briefings.
Yes, it is a really amazing thing. And there is no, I mean, what I think makes this administration, and I want to be clear, there's been corruption of some sort since the beginning of American government, and certainly in our modern history as well. What makes this administration different is that President Trump doesn't have shame about it. He projects a sense that everything is fine, and people in his administration take their cues from that. So you see other senior officials, I mean, starting with his own family members, his daughter Ivanka Trump and her husband Jared Kushner, are profiting from their businesses while they're in the White House. Several cabinet secretaries, at the top of the list is Wilbur Ross, but other ones as well, have large business holdings while they are also actively working for the people of the United States. So it's a really unprecedented situation, but there's no sense of obligation that when we ask the White House something, they should give us an answer, which is, always we've been spun, but people have tried to present something which is not an obvious lie. And that's not the case in this White House. And one of the ways that they're sort of leapfrogging over the press is by not talking to the press anymore in any kind of formal way. So, yes, those briefings, which used to be a daily occurrence at the White House, have just gone away. And the White House tells us things when it wants to tell us things, not because of any sense of obligation that public information is something that is an obligation of people who work for the taxpayers.
None of the main subjects of your book, Donald Trump, Ivanka Trump, Charles, Jared Kushner, agreed to be interviewed. You did send each of them scores of questions, and you write that Donald Trump and Ivanka Trump did not respond. Through his attorney, Charles Kushner answered some of the questions. His answers are reflected in these pages. And Jared Kushner, through a White House spokesman, addressed some factual queries, but otherwise did not answer your questions.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. There were some where they sort of clarified or gave additional context, I included that. But mostly the questions went unanswered. Now, I spoke to over 200 people for the book, including people that identified themselves and that I understood to be close to the families, the family businesses, or one of the main subjects of the book. So I was able to get perspective from people close to them. And there were many interviews that all of these people have given that I sort of mined for a greater understanding. But as has been the case also with the podcast Trump Inc., many times we will ask questions and we simply do not get a response. And it goes back to the issue that I was talking about, which is that there is sort of a broken sense of obligation or trust with journalists that there should be a sense that you should answer questions. Now, everybody, you know, obviously has sort of wriggled out of that over time, but that's what's different now.
You write that some people who consider themselves on good terms with the Trump and Kushner families did not wish to be identified in any way. And when I read that sentence, I was just curious, for those who are still connected to the families, what really struck you about what they told you? What stands out for you?
Well, I mean, I think that there are people who have worked with and I'll particularly, I think, people who've worked with Ivanka Trump found her to be sort of professional. There were people who worked with her in her first job out of college, which was for a different New York real estate developer, not her father, who described her as lovely and hardworking. There were people who described both Charles and Jared Kushner's sense of generosity. For example, Charles Kushner taking care of employees whose family members were sick and paying for health care. But there was an overwhelming sort of torrent of stories on the other side of the ledger of people that I'd spoken to who felt that they had suffered retribution or could suffer retribution from giving me their names and speaking out loud about the individuals in this book. So what I had to do in that circumstance, and, you know, this was even people, as you say, that felt like they were friendly with the family or had worked with the family or continue to work with the family. And what they said is they didn't want the trouble of having their name out there. And they were particularly afraid of the president and his bully pulpit and his Twitter feed. And, you know, we just see what he did last week with the impeachment witnesses, where he marched a lieutenant colonel out of the White House for telling the truth, essentially, for going before Congress and raising his right hand and swearing an oath and then telling members of Congress what happened on that phone call with President Zelensky. So people are afraid and didn't want to be called out. So one of the things that I really did in writing the book, and it's also a workaround that we have with our podcast, is that when people don't talk to you, you have to talk to more people to make sure that you really have the story right. But nor can you not go forward with the stories, because that would sort of mean that the forces who want to keep the truth from getting out had won.
And to add one more thing to this, because they've done such a great job of keeping so much secret, you write that almost everyone who has worked with them had to sign broad non-disclosure agreements. They cannot say anything about their experiences. Among those required to sign them were people who worked for the Trump Organization, for The Apprentice, for Ivanka Trump's business, for the Kushner family business, for Trump's campaign, and even for the White House. Ex-employees who've been given lucrative jobs in the Trump campaign, they had an obligation to stay silent with these non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's been a problem that I think is sort of, I mean, little understood. I mean, for example, we've gotten tips from people who were associate producers on The Apprentice who wanted to give us information and wanted to speak out, but were unable to do so because of the legal agreements they have signed. And it goes all the way up to former White House officials signing these agreements. And in some cases, what has happened, and there's even some tape from Lara Trump, who is Eric's Trump's wife, who worked on the Trump campaign, that Omarosa released, of her saying, of her offering a job to Omarosa post White House and saying, well, of course, this comes with a continued obligation to stay silent. That's a paraphrase, but that's essentially what she was saying. And we see many, many people being hired by the Trump campaign or Trump campaign affiliates who then continue their obligation to remain silent. In some cases, I mean, this is disturbing because you see some of these people show up as commentators on TV. So, for example, during the 2016, after one of Donald Trump's campaign managers, Corey Lewandowski, who I'm sure is a familiar name to many of your listeners, after he was fired from the campaign, he was still operating under a non-disclosure agreement, but was also a television commentator. So the ways in which the truth can be distorted go very, very deep. And that we're not even talking about the hush money payments, the whole Stormy Daniels situation, the Karen McDougal situation, Trump's agreement with the National Enquirer that they would catch and kill stories that were unfavorable to him. So there is a lot that has gone in to producing the information that we understand about Trump. And what we've been trying to do in the podcast and what I very deliberately tried to do in the book was to pierce through that by, as you say, reading everything that's available, talking to everybody that I could, and really sort of processing it all into a coherent narrative.
And that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because there's just so much. I mean, this makes your head spin. In some ways, there's so much that happens in one day, and it's hard to follow it all. And for people like on our show, for example, you know, we really care about social justice and people struggling to make ends meet and inequality and poverty and workers and, you know, all of these issues and the environment. There's so many issues that are so important. And I think so many people feel overwhelmed because there's so much happening in this administration, and it's hard to connect all of the dots. So what would you say? I mean, given that you spend, I mean, you wrote this book while you were hosting Trump Inc. You are just steeped in all of this. And what would you say is important to really follow here? I mean, even just remembering this information, this is one little graph I want to read about dark money. You write it accounts. Dark money accounts support the Trump campaign. His inaugural committee has not explained how it spent more than a third of its funds. Its deputy chair, Rick Gates, tried to keep money off the books altogether by having donors pay vendors directly. Trump's foreign campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is in prison for fraud and conspiracy against the U.S. Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is in prison for fraud, violating campaign finance laws, lying to Congress. A campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos, served a sentence for lying to the FBI. Trump's deputy campaign manager, Gates, and national security advisor, Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to the same crime. I mean, that, Andrea, is just one small paragraph in your book.
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of things that I want to say. First of all, in the book, American Oligarchs, I really did try to write it as a story. And this went through many, many edits. And the first draft I handed in was several hundred pages longer.
Wow.
And I really cut back because I thought to myself, it's not important. It's not as important that people have every piece of information as they understand the structure and the through line and the multi-generational narrative that got us to where we are today. So the stuff that has happened since Trump was elected and during the campaign is actually only part of Act 4 and Act 5 of the book. It is a book that is written in five acts. And I also wanted it to really come across that it's not just a story about these two families, that they're not just an aberration. Trump just didn't pop up and manage to have everything go his way and won the election. But that Trump was created and enabled by a system of widening inequality in our country, by tax cuts and deregulation that allowed people to get richer. And then what do rich people do when they get richer? They spend money on politics so that they can get even richer. Mm. And there was this cycle. I mean, I think the most dramatic example was the Citizens United decision, which we just passed the 10th anniversary of last month, which allowed so much money to flow into the political system that it became almost impossible to track. And there's a scene in the book where I talk about traveling to Canton, Ohio in 2010, where I was in my hotel room and I was preparing my materials to file my story and watching TV, as I frequently do, because it's a way of reporting. And there were so many ads on. And the ads had prison bars, and they had bags of cash. And they kept saying, your member of Congress is terrible. Your member of Congress is a crook. Everything short of your member of Congress has kidnapped your wife. Well, if you are living in a swing state, and you're getting subject to this barrage of advertisements, and this wasn't just in Ohio, this was in all of the swing states, and it went on for years and years and years and years and years, and it kept going through 2016. If you're a TV viewer or a consumer of television in any form, well, what's your rational reaction? Your rational reaction is to say government is broken, it's terrible, and that's the situation that Trump walked right into to say, I alone can fix it. And he was able to capitalize on that extreme distrust of government. But of course, when he got to Washington, instead of doing things to rebuild that trust, he allowed even more money into politics and cut taxes even further and invited even more different ways of lobbying because he's such a obviously transactional businessman. He made it clear from the moment he was elected that if people paid them money, he would look favorably on him. And if you are someone who runs a business, it's a very rational decision that you would pay Trump money because it's probably, for most businesses, not a lot of money in the context of it to get something that you want. And Trump has shown that his administration has an open door policy towards responding to people who have paid him through his campaign committees, through allied committees, or just paid him directly.
Today, we're joined by Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the award-winning podcast Trump Inc., and she's out with a new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. And if you have a question for Andrea, she has done extensive research. She's read over 100,000 pages of documents, more than 100 books, thousands and thousands of news articles, and she describes in detail how the Kushner and Trump families profit from a system of corruption and dark money. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Oh, morning, Rose. I'm interested. There's a kind of a famous legacy of Trump that he never pays his debts. And so when it gets into this strong arm practice and his kind of army of supporters, I've been surprised that this has gone on for 3 years.
David?
Oh, yeah, I heard a beep there, I guess.
No, you're still there, go ahead.
Good. Yeah, that this has gone on for 3 years, and if Trump is famous for only paying 30% of his debts, and people are strong-arming in his name, how is he able to pull that off? Are there people that are... I'm wondering if he has S&M freaks that are actually doing it for free. I don't know if you've heard the headlines today. Roger Stone. He was supposed to get a 9-year sentence. Trump tweeted about Roger Stone, and all of a sudden his 9-year sentence is in flux again.
Well, thank you. Andrea, you write extensively about debt. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true that Trump did not pay his debts, has a history of not paying his debts. He didn't pay the contractor who molded the minarets and domes for the Trump Taj Mahal casino. There were many people that I spoke to, lawyers, vendors, who said that Trump would call them up and say, "You're getting so much for working for me. It's such a big benefit to you. You need to cut my rates or cut them at all." Michael Cohen testified to Congress about this. He said that it was his job. Trump would say, someone would come in and they would say, "You owe me money." And Trump would say, "Michael, take them into a room. You can do a deal with them." And what Michael Cohen said was that meant that he was supposed to give them maybe 20% on the dollar. And he did. And he said that he eventually heard from someone who said, "You put me out of business by not paying me." And it's one of the things I really track in the book is the phenomenon of people being attracted by what they see as a glamorous world that Trump is presenting them, a world with simple solutions, and they become enthralled by that promise to the extent that they don't see what's in front of them. And there are people who've worked for Trump who said, "I just don't understand why people continued to work for him when they didn't pay him." Trump himself has gotten out of paying huge debts. He has, for example, sued his former banker, Deutsche Bank, when he owed them money. And so it is I don't know the psychology of the people. I'm not a psychologist, but it is a phenomenon around Trump that he's able to offer people something they want to believe in, even against their own material interests. And it extends all the way back into his days as a businessman to his earliest days as a businessman in New York.
And it still continues to this day. Last night, he was in New Hampshire and 11,000 people showed up for his rally. 11,000 people.
I mean, I think that there are obviously quite a few people who support Trump and who see what he has done effectively is made a lot of voters feel like attacks on him are attacks on them. Mm. And even though he's an extremely wealthy man and has been almost a millionaire since he was a toddler, he has been able to play up his sense of grievance in a way that people who are genuinely aggrieved, who can't find work, who have been treated badly, who can't afford housing, who can't afford health care, feel like he is standing up for them, even though his administration is doing the exact opposite, is making it harder for poor people to keep their money. For example, his tax cut favored wealthy people, disfavored most everybody else. He is in court right now trying to overturn the Affordable Care Act. So there are many ways in which he's acting in the direct economic disinterest, and yet people have transmuted that into somehow he is acting in their interest.
Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Andrea Bernstein. She's co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica, and she's out with a new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is KALW San Francisco. Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the New Hampshire results, and then we will talk about the candidates' records on racial justice. There's a racial justice scorecard out from the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, and we've been noticing that so much of the media coverage is focusing on, you know, whether people are going to go for the, in their terms, the moderate or the liberal wing of the party. But what about where these candidates stand on issues and what they would actually do? So we're going to be doing a couple of shows before Super Tuesday about where these candidates actually stand on issues, because there are some major, major differences, especially when it comes to racial justice and the environment. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by Andrea Bernstein. She's an award-winning journalist, co-host of Trump Inc., and author of the new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. And for this book, she did a lot of research because these families are very secretive. She read over 100,000 pages of documents, more than 100 books, and thousands of news articles. And she argues that in building and maintaining their wealth, the families came to embody the rising nationalism and inequality that pushed the U.S. to the brink of oligarchy. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Andrea, we had a question earlier about Roger Stone, and this is just breaking. So I just want to read this. It looks like it's, I just pulled up USA Today. Donald Trump attacked the potential prison sentence for Roger Stone in a tweet Tuesday, reviving speculation over whether Trump would use his pardon power in the case. He said he retweeted a news story about how prosecutors have recommended a 9-year sentence or up to 9 years for Stone. And Trump said this is a horrible and very unfair situation. The real crimes are on the other side as nothing happens to them.
So Roger Stone is actually, I mentioned that my book is in five acts, and Roger Stone is one of the characters that shows up in act two in the beginning of the book, and then comes back again in Act 5. And, of course, when I started writing the book, I didn't actually realize that he was going to be sort of coming back around and was going to be indicted and convicted of lying to Congress. And, I think it's worth pointing out that he's going to prison, presumably, because he tried to interfere with an investigation. He tried to get a witness to lie to Congress. He threatened to witness a witness. And while he was on trial, he threatened the judge in violation of a gag order. In my book, I write about how Roger Stone met Donald Trump. So Roger Stone was an acolyte of the lawyer Roy Cohn, most famous or infamous for his role in the McCarthy hearings. Roger Stone worked on the Reagan campaign in 1980, living in Roy Cohn's townhouse, and really sort of learned from Roy Cohn this brand of aggressive politics and business in which there were no lines. So he learned that you get somebody elected, Roger Stone would get somebody elected, like the governor of New Jersey, and then you could go back to that person and ask for favors for your client. One of his clients was Donald Trump. They met. They worked together on a number of shady schemes. Donald Trump wanted to run somebody against a state senator in Atlantic City that he thought was against his interests. Roger Stone and Donald Trump were given the biggest lobbying fine in the history of New York State for running an illegal and racist a lobbying campaign against an Indian tribe that wanted to set up a casino, which would have been a rival to Donald Trump's casino. They kept the whole thing secret. So there is Roger Stone, sort of the devil on Trump's shoulder, encouraging him to commit acts like this all the way up until the 2016 campaign, in which he played no formal role. But in the sentencing document that prosecutors released yesterday, they made it clear that Trump was giving information to senior, that Roger Stone was giving information to senior Trump campaign officials, notably Rick Gates, who you mentioned, Steve Bannon. He was giving them information about upcoming WikiLeaks releases, which they understood to be non-public information. So all of that we just learned yesterday, and prosecutors are arguing for a severe sentence for Roger Stone. Now, will Trump pardon him? I think we don't know. I mean, Trump's indicated that he thinks that Paul Manafort was unfairly tried. One of the reasons that Rudy Giuliani went to Ukraine was to try to discredit the underpinnings of the evidence that was used to convict Paul Manafort. But he hasn't moved to pardon any of the people that have been involved in anything involving his world as of yet, although he has pardoned other people and talked about pardoning other people who have been convicted of corruption-related crimes in the past.
You mentioned before Donald Trump's influence and his close connection to such a wide range of people. And it was very interesting to read the wedding guest list of Ivanka and Jared Trump, Jared Kushner. I think this just says so much about the family's influence. I mean, just a couple names of people who went to their wedding: the governors of Florida and Pennsylvania, Charlie Crist and Ed Rendell, the attorney general and comptroller of New York, Andrew Cuomo, and Tom DiNapoli. Thank you, DiNapoli. The speakers of the New York State Assembly, the mayor of Newark at the time, Cory Booker, the New York Police Commissioner, Ray Kelly, city school chancellor. I mean, what a who's who of New Jersey and New York politics.
Right. I mean, so the wedding scene is the wedding is the prologue to the book. And one of the reasons that I wanted to put it at the beginning of the book is because it's a book about the marriage of money and power. And this is obviously a marriage, but also a wedding is a moment that something happens where people come and they witness an event. And for Donald Trump, it is very important to assemble people for events like this. He actually boasted during an early debate in the Republican primary in 2016, that Hillary Clinton came to his wedding, to Melania, because he had given money to her foundation. So he sees his wedding guest list, by his own admission, in a transactional way, that these are people who feel a sense of obligation to him. But also he creates a sense of obligation and expectation. There were people that could regulate his businesses who were at this event. Law enforcers, the police commissioner of New York City was there. People that if Trump ever ran afoul of the law would theoretically be in a position of having to prosecute him. These are the kinds of people that Trump drew close as a businessman and still does as a way to exercise power and dominance. And it's something that we see over and over and over again, particularly with regulators and law enforcement officials. Trump draws them close and expects them to be close, expects them to be on his side. And we saw in the Mueller investigation this almost sense of shock that he couldn't just control law enforcement officials to his liking. Although we certainly see with the outcome of the impeachment trial and the acquittal last week and his subsequent press conference or speech, whatever that was after, Not a press conference, not a speech, Trump said.
Right.
It's just a whatever. But we see that he doesn't actually believe that he should be subject to the rules that apply to everybody else, precisely because he's done such a great job over the years, from his perspective, of keeping himself out from under the thumb of the law by drawing the people who could make those decisions close to him.
Andrea Bernstein is an award-winning journalist. We're talking with her about her new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Charles in Mountain View. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know,
Charles, we can't hear you. I think you have a bad line. Maybe try again.
Okay.
Charles?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we have Charles' question. Charles is asking if anything can be done to dissuade Trump voters from his fan base.
It does seem like this election is over a very small slice of voters. I've been to Trump rallies, and there is a sense of sort of love and joy, but also a sense of sort of grievance that he plays on. I mean, one of the things that you see at Trump rallies that I have never seen at other political rallies is that people in the crowd actually turn on people who are protesting in the crowd. And there's a sense that anything could happen, including violence at a Trump rally. They turn on the media, they turn on protesters. So there is this mix, but there does seem to be this sort of self-reinforcing circle. And we did an episode of Trump Inc. about Brad Perscale, who is Trump's campaign manager. And it was back in the fall, and I played an extended piece of tape from this event, which was also in New Hampshire, because I thought that it was really important for people to sort of understand the love that Trump's fans have for him, and that it's not a question of sort of rationality or talking people out of it. But, you know, one of the things I felt strongly about was, so the last word of my book is hope. And I wanted it to be not just, okay, here's a century's worth of stories about how our democracy is unraveling, but I wanted it to create a real sense of hope and space. And a lot of times people would say to me, okay, so you're doing these stories. Well, what are they going to do? Are they going to result in a criminal trial? Are they going to result in convictions? And many stories that we have done and that I have done have resulted in those things. But what feels to me so important in this moment is the act of documentation itself, because truth is under assault by Donald Trump and his supporters. There's a sense in which there's nothing facts-based, science is being attacked, scientists are being fired from his administration, wholesale divisions of different parts of U.S. agencies, which their job is to do science, are being cut right now. But what that means is that when people confront me, they say, well, something is an opinion. It's your opinion. If you live in a world where there is only opinion and no truth, you create a world where there is no possibility even of common ground. And I still believe that in the documenting and in the laying out of what we have, that in itself is an important act, because it's insisting, yes, there is some objective truth and there's a collective space that we can hang on to. So for me personally, that seems an essential task of this moment, which is to lay out what we understand about the truth and to sort of fight for the existence of truth itself.
Well, thank you for that call. And sorry, we had problems with your phone line. Let's go next to Amanda in San Francisco. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. And I have a very relevant question to ask your guest. I heard on the radio, because I don't really watch TV, and it would have either been on BBC or NPR, it was a very buried news story. And what I heard was that Trump was found innocent of the Emollient Clause lawsuit. And I want an update on that.
Yeah, okay. So there are a number of Emoluments Clause lawsuits working their ways through the court. The one that you're referring to was brought by members of Congress. And the ruling was that members of Congress cannot do that, that they cannot sue in their capacity, that the appropriate way for Congress to act is to act legislatively, not through a lawsuit by individual members. So it was thrown out on that reason. There are two other emoluments lawsuits that are working their way through the courts. One was brought by the district, by the Attorney General of the District of Columbia and the Attorney General of Maryland, where they're arguing that Trump, by taking payments from foreign leaders at the Trump International Hotel, is violating the Emoluments Clause. Mm-hmm. That case is currently under consideration by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia. There was a case in New York that was brought on the very first day of the Trump administration that a federal judge dismissed, but then that case is now on appeal and being considered at the appeals level. So there's a couple of other emoluments cases that could result in a ruling. I mean, the emoluments clause, for people who don't know, says that a president cannot take anything of value or any emolument from a foreign leader. And the argument is that by accepting money from foreign governments and people who work for foreign governments at his hotel, he is doing just that because he has not separated himself from his business. The remedy that a lot of these lawsuits are asking for is that he separate himself from his business.
Right.
So it's untested. There's never been any litigation in the entire history of the Republic about the Emoluments Clause. So whatever we're up to 230-some-odd years later after the Constitution was written, we may get a judicial interpretation, but we are not done yet.
Well, to your point of hope, there's still hope alive, Finn. At least a little.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. Andrea, it seems like every couple weeks there's a new story about how Trump is profiting from his businesses. The Washington Post just had a piece recently. Secret Service has paid rates as high as $650 a night for rooms at Trump's properties. There was another piece from Business Insider that Trump's Super Bowl weekend trip to Mar-a-Lago ran taxpayers $3.4 million. Courts in November, Trump golf cart rentals have cost taxpayers $550,000. I mean, you've reported on all of this for Trump Inc. What really stands out for you the most? And do you think that he will ever be held accountable for this? And what precedent does this set?
So I am not sure what held accountable means, but I think he is being held accountable in some sense by the Washington Post, which is their reporter David Farenthold has been doing a terrific job of tracking this. What we are learning is a couple of things. So is one of the two that Donald in charge of his business in terms of day-to-day management. When Trump went to the White House, told the Washington Post last year quite clearly that when the president requires Secret Service and other staff to accompany him to his properties, where he spends one third of his time at least, that they would charge cost. But what the Washington Post found was that they were being charged $650 a night, $17,000 a week for a cottage at Mar-a-Lago, even for when the president wasn't there, that they were, in fact, being charged top dollar. The reason this has been so hard to find is that the Trump administration, unlike previous administrations, stopped disclosing when taxpayer funds were being spent at Trump properties in a federal database. And they've had to go through a big FOIL process and requesting specific documents from individual agencies because they are no longer being filed in the federal database. But it's clear that the Washington Post has made this a big project for 2020, as have a number of other news outlets, to really try to understand the extent of Trump payments to his own property. Because, of course, Trump himself is deciding how much time to spend at these properties and also setting the rates. This is taxpayer money that's being spent. So these quantities of money are like nothing we've seen before. And, of course, let's not forget that until he walked it back, it was President Trump's intention to hold next summer's G7 conference at the Trump Doral. And that was announced from the White House by the acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney. That was also at the infamous press conference where he told people to get over it, that Trump had called Zelensky to ask for help with an investigation.
What about Ivanka and Jared? When they became senior White House advisors, it was reported that they made about $82 million in income. And the Times last year reported that they made $135 million while supposedly working for the public. What can you tell us about how they have profited under this administration?
Right. So this is the extraordinary thing. And this is not the value of their assets. This is the amount of money that the businesses that they're still tied to are throwing off while they're in the White House. A good deal of that is coming from Kushner's various properties that his company, his family company, still owns. He was CEO. He resigned as CEO, but he did not fully divest from his company. And when he did divest, he basically divested to his close relatives. So, for example, to his mother, his sister, his brother, who are now controlling his interests. But it's certainly not an arm's length transaction. So what we see is these immensely wealthy people who are making money from their family businesses while they're in the White House. And sometimes the decisions that they make, the things that they work for in the White House, affect their family businesses. So Ivanka Trump was a very big advocate of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. She went on television. She talked about the family leave provisions. But what she didn't make clear was that when you looked at the bill's winners and losers, as the New York Times did when the bill was passed, what they found was the biggest winners were real estate companies of the type that the Trump and Kushner family had. They were the biggest winners from that tax bill. There's another provision in the tax bill called Opportunity Zones, which is a big tax break for businesses that are investing in lower income census tracts. But the bill is so broadly written that it's basically just another tax cut for people who have a lot of money to invest, who tend to be wealthy people. So what Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump have done is institutionalize this money-making mechanism, which they were already benefiting from. There was a study done by a professor, a couple of professors at UC Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zuckman, which was what happened to the very, very wealthy after the Reagan tax cuts of 1981. Their income goes up so fast, it looks like the right-hand side of the letter U, while the income for people at the bottom end of the scale has stagnated. Well, that class where the income is rising incredibly quickly is the class that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner are in. And by their actions, they have made it much easier for people like them to make even more money, while people at the lower end of the income scale are continuing to see, even though people are making money and unemployment is down, costs are so high for housing, for healthcare, for education, that the people at the bottom of the scale are not feeling any richer.
Right. And I think you did a great job of writing about the history of this and how before Reagan, you actually had a large chunk of wealth going to the workers. And because of policy, that has completely flipped.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, it's easy to forget, but during World War II and after World War II, there was a sort of pro-tax ideology in the United States. So during the war, President Roosevelt said the membership dues of living in a civilized society is taxes. This is something we have to pay to be part of this club that is civilized society. And after the war, the marginal tax rates were so high. That is, the amount of money that would be taxed on the income you made above a certain amount. So I forget what the numbers were, but it was maybe above $25 million. If you made this amount of money, you would be taxed so much that you couldn't make any more. 94% was the tax rate. And what that meant is that society was more equal because it just wasn't worth it to make more money because you weren't going to be able to keep it. And that what has happened as taxes have been lowered is not that more money is going into the economy broadly, it's that more money is going to richer people. And that's been documented in a whole variety of ways. And accompanying it is something that the Trump family is well practiced in, which is avoiding taxes. So they were actually kind of early adopter tax avoiders in the Trump family. But as the sense of moral obligation that paying taxes is an important thing of being part of society, as that has become less and less, more and more people figure, well, if paying taxes are bad, then I'm not going to do it. And tax evasion and tax avoidance are on the rise.
Right. Andrew, we have about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I just wonder if there's one story in the book that you uncovered that you wish got more attention, because I've been reading media coverage of your book, and a lot of journalists have written about Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump, quote, knew they were lying over a ploy to sell condos. According to your book, there's a lot of stories about that one, which is very important. But I just wonder if there's something that stood out for you that you would like to get more attention.
So there's a story about Michael Cohen and Don McGahn, who is probably known to many of your listeners as the former White House counsel. And it's interesting, Don McGahn, his father had actually worked for Trump in Atlantic City. He was a fixer. And he used to sort of try to minimize the shady characters and mobsters that Donald Trump was dealing with, to minimize the connections and sort of keep them out of sight. So that was Patty McGahn. That was Don McGahn's uncle. And Don McGahn, in an early iteration, was the FEC commissioner. And the FEC was in charge of investigating campaign finance violations. Under Don McGahn, they went from approximately 600 investigations a year to about a fifth that. He went in with the very explicit idea that campaign finance laws were not going to be enforced. And one of the cases that came before him involved Michael Cohen and Donald Trump using the resources of the Trump administration to illegally support Trump's trial bid for president in 2011. At least that's what's being investigated, whether that ran afoul of the laws. Don McGahn killed that investigation. And, of course, something very similar is what happened with Stormy Daniels and Individual One, Donald Trump, in the 2016 campaign. So it has always fascinated me that Don McGahn, as FEC commissioner, was able to bury a case that then came back and could have affected the outcome of the 2016 election.
Hmm. And final thoughts, Andrea, just about media. Every Friday we talk about media coverage. And I just wonder what you think, where we're headed in this election. Media, especially media coverage of Donald Trump. Jay Rosen, journalism professor at NYU, has been very critical of the both sides reporting that we're seeing more of. And he says, you know, we really have to talk about what this administration is doing to democracy. We cannot do old-fashioned both sides reporting.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the other thing is that there's so much disinformation that's already coming into this election. It's in the Democratic primary. It's certainly going to be in the general election. We can expect the Russians and everyone else are gearing in because they've now learned just how easy it is to spread misinformation in an election. So when you have a situation like that, you can't just go out and talk to people because you don't understand the information stream. So we need to have a very sophisticated understanding of how that is working. And we also need to understand that this is a president who as of January, so it's probably many more than this now, but had told 16,000 lies and misrepresentations during his presidency. So I think it's both important to point that out and to not get tangled up in disproving every statement, because then you lose the forest for the trees. And I think it's very important to understand what is broadly happening to our democracy and wealth inequality and money in politics versus what is specifically a subject of debate at any given moment.
Andrea Bernstein is an award-winning journalist, co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast, and author of the new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your work.
And thank you so much, and thanks to everyone who called. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.